This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Blitzscaling, the lightning-fast path to building massively valuable businesses by Reid Hoffman and Chris Yeh. Read by Chris Yeh. Introduction read by Reid Hoffman.
Foreword by Bill Gates. I've known Reid Hoffman for years. Our friendship started on my visits to Silicon Valley to meet with Greylock Partners, the venture capital firm where Reid is a partner, so I could learn about the companies they were investing in. I was always impressed by his sharp mind and brilliant business sense. Reid is famous for hosting long dinners where the conversation runs late into the night, and we've spent many meals breaking down the technology industry, analyzing the promise of artificial intelligence, and more. When Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella started talking about acquiring LinkedIn, I knew it would be an amazing fit. Of all the things I've discussed with Reid, the most thought-provoking might be blitzscaling. It is an idea that applies to many different industries, as he and Chris explain in the last section of this book. But prioritizing speed over efficiency, even in the face of uncertainty, is especially important when your business model depends on having lots of members and getting feedback from them. If you get in early and start getting that feedback and your competitors don't, then you're on the path to success. In any business where scale matters, getting in early and doing it fast can make the difference. This is especially true for two-sided business models where you have two user groups that create positive network effects for each other. For example, LinkedIn wants to attract people who are looking for work as well as employers who want to hire them. Airbnb wants guests looking for a place to stay as well as hosts with space to rent. Uber wants to attract drivers as well as riders. And a software company with an operating system to sell wants app developers as well as end users. Microsoft definitely went through a blitzscaling phase, although we didn't call it that at the time. We got on the learning curve early and were able to build a reputation as a serious company. We had an extreme culture of working hard and getting things done fast. The ideas behind blitzscaling aren't just for startups and scale-ups. They're important for big established companies too. The window for action can be tiny, and it can close quickly. Even a few months' hesitation can mean the difference between leading and chasing. Reid and Chris's ideas are more practical than ever because it is now possible to get big fast in a way that simply wasn't feasible a few decades ago. There is a rich ecosystem of service providers and outsourcing companies to support rapid growth. Many companies have gone through their own big growth spurts, so there are lots of examples to learn from. User feedback comes in a constant stream of data. Product cycles have dropped from yearly to weekly or daily. And good reviews can spread in an instant online, so a strong product can quickly attract a big audience. In other words, the case studies you're about to explore and the tools you're about to gain have never been more relevant. This is an ideal moment to be listening to this book. I'm glad Reid and Chris are sharing their insights.
Introduction. 2011, San Francisco, Airbnb headquarters. They're probably going to kill you. The year was 2011, and in the offices of Airbnb, then a scrappy little 40-person startup, its co-founder and CEO, Brian Chesky, had just received some very bad news. Brian pondered the implications of the ominous prediction he'd just heard from Andrew Mason, the co-founder and CEO of Groupon. He didn't like it. Brian and his co-founders, Joe Gebbia and Nathan Blacharczyk, had already fought their way through plenty of obstacles to build Airbnb, a website that makes it easy for people to rent out their rooms or homes for the night. In the beginning, every investor the founders approached had turned them down, or worse, ignored them. The company was on the upswing now, but the painful early days were still fresh in their minds, and they weren't looking for another battle. When the Airbnb founders first met, Paul Graham, the highly regarded founder of the startup accelerator, Y Combinator, or YC, told them flat out that their idea was terrible. "People are actually doing this?" he incredulously asked. When Brian told him yes, people were, in fact, renting out their living spaces for a night, Graham's response was, "What's wrong with them?" Still, Graham had accepted the Airbnb guys into a three-month-long YC program. Not because he was inspired by their Airbnb business or because he was impressed by the hustle of the founders. He loved the now famous story about how Chesky and his co-founders managed to pay the bills while trying to get Airbnb off the ground. It was 2008, a U.S. presidential election year, so they created and sold special edition cereals called Obama-O's and Cap'n McCain's, a sugary parody of, or tribute to, depending on how you look at it, that year's candidates Barack Obama and John McCain. The creativity and persistence displayed by the Airbnb founders as serial entrepreneurs got them in the door at YC. Once in the program, they refined their business and were able to persuade two leading venture capital firms, Sequoia Capital and Greylock Partners, where I'm a general partner, to invest. Now, nearly 4 years later, it seemed like all the hard work was finally starting to pay off. Having celebrated its millionth booking, Airbnb had plenty of working capital, and it was clear that the concept was valuable. But when you're successful, you attract competition, and sometimes that competition represents a deadly threat. In Airbnb's case, that threat was three brothers from Cologne, Germany, Oliver, Mark, and Alexander Samwer. They had become billionaires by analyzing successful U.S. companies, rapidly creating copycats in Europe, and in many cases, selling those cloned companies to their original American inspirations. In other cases, the Samwers actually held onto and built out their clones. Zalando, the Zappos of Europe, has over 10,000 employees and was worth more than $10 billion in 2017. Their first success was Zalando, an eBay knockoff they were able to sell to eBay for $43 million, just 100 days after launching it. The Samwer brothers then invested in the German versions of YouTube as MyVideo, Twitter as Fraser, and Facebook as StudiVZ, before founding their own startup studio, Rocket Internet. In early 2011, Brian and his team started noticing that Airbnb users were being spammed by a new company called Wimdu. Wimdu had apparently just received $90 million, the largest investment in a European startup to date, from none other than Rocket Internet and Kinnevik, a major Swedish investment company that had partnered with the Samwer brothers. The problem? Wimdu's business model and website looked like a knockoff of Airbnb's. Wimdu was founded in March 2011, and within weeks, the Berlin-based company had hired a staggering 400 employees and opened 20 offices across Europe. Meanwhile, the original, but much smaller, Airbnb had only raised $7 million, had just 40 employees, and operated out of a single office in San Francisco. As a first-time CEO, Brian wasn't even sure what was involved in opening a second office, let alone dozens more on another continent. Brian also knew that if Wimdu was able to capture and dominate the European market, Airbnb might not survive. "If you're a travel site and you don't cover Europe, you're dead," he told us in 2015 when he visited the technology-enabled blitzscaling class we taught at Stanford University. The Samwer brothers had named their price. Airbnb could have Wimdu in exchange for a 25% stake in Airbnb. Now, Brian faced a difficult decision with painful consequences, regardless of what option he chose. In response, Brian turned to one of his favorite decision-making techniques, reaching out to the world's leading experts. His first call was to the CEO of Groupon at the time, Andrew Mason. The leading daily deals company had had a similar experience the previous year. In December 2009, the Samwer brothers had just launched CityDeal, their Groupon lookalike. 6 months later, Groupon paid a nine-figure price, roughly 10% of its valuation at that point, to acquire this competitor. Here was the question weighing heavily on Brian and his team. Should Airbnb follow Groupon's strategy and just buy the knockoff company? Brian's gut instinct was to say no. Integrating Wimdu's finance-centric and metric-driven team could harm Airbnb's design-driven culture. He was also reluctant to reward what he saw as a legal extortion racket rather than a sincere attempt to create value in the market. Yet Brian felt he had an obligation to consider the offer. Mason had told him that despite the many problems the CityDeal acquisition had brought, it had also accelerated Groupon's progress into the European market, which ended up accounting for nearly 30% of its global sales. It could easily be argued that giving up 10% of Groupon for CityDeal was actually a good deal. But perhaps, emboldened by their successful CityDeal gambit, the Samvers were asking for a far larger share of Airbnb, a full 25%. On the other hand, Airbnb could reject the offer and instead take on the aggressive Samver brothers in a head-to-head competition. But Wimdu had the home turf advantage, not to mention 10 times the number of employees and more than 10 times the amount of invested capital. Competing against them would be one hell of an uphill battle. Tired of the fundraising grind, especially its emotional toll, Brian wondered whether he had it in him to take on this new and likely bruising fight. But he and his team had spent 18 seemingly fruitless months working on Airbnb before entering Y Combinator, racking up tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt. After all the blood, sweat, and tears, were they really willing to give up a quarter of their company? Ultimately, Brian decided not to buy Wimdu, swayed in part by the arguments of his key advisors. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg counseled him to fight. "Don't buy them," he said. "The best product will win." YC's Paul Graham gave similar feedback. "They're mercenaries. You're missionaries," he told Brian. "They're like people raising a baby they don't actually want." When Brian reached out to me for my advice in the situation, I too advised him not to buy Wimdu. The key issue wasn't the price and dilution, but the way a merger could pose impediments to speed and success. Buying Wimdu adds a substantial amount of integration risk, which tripped up Groupon after buying CityDeal, I told him. Merging company cultures and company management could create potentially fatal risks, especially if it slows us down. "With Airbnb, we have a business that's already benefiting from network effects. We can win." I stand by that advice today. In the end, Airbnb's founders realized that they wanted to take on the Samvers, and they wanted to win. But how? The key was an aggressive, all-out program of growth that we call blitzscaling. Blitzscaling drives lightning growth by prioritizing speed over efficiency, even in an environment of uncertainty. It's a set of specific strategies and tactics that allowed Airbnb to beat the Samver brothers in their own game. Just a few months later, determined to acquire the resources needed to outscale the Samvers, Brian raised $112 million in additional venture capital. Airbnb then embarked on an aggressive international expansion plan, including the acquisition of Acolio, a smaller and more affordable German Airbnb clone. By the spring of 2012, Airbnb had opened 9 international offices, setting up shop in London, Hamburg, Berlin, Paris, Milan, Barcelona, Copenhagen, Moscow, and Sao Paulo. Bookings had grown 10 times since the previous February, and in June 2012, Airbnb announced its 10 millionth booking. "The Samvers gave us a gift," Brian admitted, many years later, in our blitzscaling class. "They forced us to scale faster than we ever would have." By choosing to grow at a breakneck pace, Airbnb had achieved the dominant position in its market. Despite the initial advantages that the Berlin-based Wimdu had in human resources, financial capital, and European market knowledge, the techniques that Brian and his co-founders implemented allowed Airbnb to meet and ultimately defeat its challenger. 2010, Shenzhen, China, Tencent headquarters. About a year before Airbnb embarked on its blitzscaling journey, in a different CEO's office on the other side of the world, the message that would change everything, arrived in the middle of the night. It was the fall of 2010, and Pony Ma, Chinese name Ma Watan, was trying to figure out what came next for Tencent. The company he had run since founding it in 1998 with four classmates from Shenzhen University. Thanks to its core product, the QQ Instant Messaging Service, which had 650 million monthly active users, Tencent had become one of China's most valuable internet companies with revenues of nearly $2 billion, a market capitalization of over $33 billion, and more than 10,000 employees. However, QQ was now a mature desktop product based on late 1990s technology, and its user base had stopped growing. Its American counterpart, AOL Instant Messenger, was already in a swift decline. Ma was convinced that Tencent had to develop a new breakthrough product for the emerging smartphone platform, or else. Internet companies that can react will survive, he said, and those who can't will die. The message Pony Ma read that night was from one of Tencent's employees, Alan Zhong, Chinese name Zhong Xiaolong, a fellow entrepreneur whose company, Foxmail, Tencent had acquired 5 years earlier. Zhong now ran the company's Guangzhou R&D division, which was a two-hour drive from Tencent's Shenzhen headquarters. He had been monitoring the rapid growth of a new social messaging product called Kick, which was especially popular among young people. He decided that Tencent needed to create its own social messenger for smartphones, and quickly. Zhang's proposal represented not only a huge opportunity, but also a huge risk, with equally huge uncertainty about the outcome. While a new messenger service might appeal to young consumers, it was probably going to cannibalize QQ, which was, after all, Tencent's core business. Furthermore, Tencent had partnered with leading mobile carriers like China Mobile to receive 40% of the SMS charges that QQ users racked up when they sent messages to mobile phones. A new service could hurt Tencent's financial bottom line and at the same time risk its relationships with some of China's most powerful companies. It was the sort of decision that publicly traded 10,000-person companies typically refer to a committee for further study. But Ma wasn't a typical corporate executive. That very night, he gave Zhong the go-ahead to pursue the idea. Zhong put together a 10-person team, including 7 engineers, to build and launch the new product. In just 2 months, Zhong's small team had built a mobile-first social messaging network with a clean, minimalistic design that was the polar opposite of QQ. Ma named the service WeChat, which means micro-message in Mandarin. Outside of China, the service became known as WeChat. What came next was staggering. Just 16 months after Zhang's fateful late-night message to Ma, WeChat celebrated its 100 millionth user. 6 months after that, it had grown to 200 million users. 4 months after that, it had grown to 300 million users. Pony Ma's late-night bet paid off handsomely. Tencent reported 2016 revenues of $22 billion, up 48% from the previous year, and up nearly 700% since 2010, the year before WeChat's launch. By early 2018, Tencent reached a market capitalization of over $500 billion, making it one of the world's most valuable companies. And WeChat was one of the most widely and intensively used services in the world. Fast Company called WeChat China's app for everything. And the Financial Times reported more than half of its users spent over 90 minutes a day using the app. To put WeChat in an American context, it's as if one single service combined the functions of Facebook, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Venmo, Grubhub, Amazon, Uber, Apple Pay, Gmail, and even Slack into a single mega service. You can use WeChat to do run-of-the-mill things like texting and calling people, participating in social media and reading articles. But you can also book a taxi, buy movie tickets, make doctor's appointments, send money to friends, play games, pay your rent, order dinner for the night, plus so much more. All from a single app on your smartphone. Ma himself recognized the importance of the decision he had made, saying in an interview, "Looking back, those 2 months were a matter of life and death." These stories of extreme growth, whether in California or halfway around the world in China, are perfect examples of why it's valuable to study what blitzscaling is and how it works. Throughout this book, we will be telling the stories of various blitzscalers. Appendix B, The Blitzscalers, includes brief profiles of these companies that provide more context. For even more background, visit blitzscaling.com. Blitzscaling, the secret weapon for building scale-ups. When a startup matures to the point where it has a killer product, a clear and sizable market, and a robust distribution channel, it has the opportunity to become a scale-up, which is a world-changing company that touches millions or even billions of lives. Often, the fastest and most direct path from startup to scale-up is the hypergrowth produced by blitzscaling. The enterprise software company, Slack, reached this critical stage once it was able to demonstrate the rapid and accelerating adoption of its team messaging apps by its initial market of software development teams. Nearly 5 years passed between the time when Slack was founded and the initial launch of its product. But once it launched, Slack users themselves drove user growth by adding many colleagues at a time, aided by a frictionless process that allowed new users to jump in with a simple web application or by downloading a mobile app from iTunes or Google Play. After the company reached this point, it began to scale rapidly, adding employees, capital, and customers at a blistering pace. Slack had raised $17 million during the first 5 years of its life. Within 8 months of launch, it had raised another $163 million and a total of $800 million by late 2017. Any company, whether a global giant or a startup in a co-founder's garage, would love to launch and grow killer businesses like Airbnb, WeChat, and Slack. Yet those who actually manage to do so, especially to the degree that Brian Chesky and Pony Ma did, are still exceedingly rare. Why is that? What sets these companies apart from the rest? In this book, we will argue that the key to rapidly building massive businesses in today's environment is the aggressive growth strategy of blitzscaling, a set of techniques that allows both startups and established companies to build dominant, world-leading businesses in record time. Entering the blitzscaling era. Over the past two decades, the internet has completely reshaped both our daily lives and the world of business. Netscape's blockbuster IPO on August 9, 1995, marked the beginning of both the dot-com boom and what I call the networked age. At the time, the rising stock prices of the dot-com boom attracted the most attention. But, in retrospect, the biggest challenge was that the internet was beginning to connect all of us to people, information, resources, and other networks. There have been other revolutions in the past, steam, electricity, and radio spring to mind. But what makes the impact of the internet so unique and so far-reaching is the fact that it has made everything so much faster. Today, every individual can connect to any other individual immediately. That increased velocity and what makes blitzscaling possible and so powerful. The speed of the internet has generated a number of second-order effects that have changed how businesses and organizations can grow. For example, the internet has made it possible to access global markets and tap into massively scalable distribution channels in a way that wasn't feasible during earlier eras. But perhaps the most important impact for businesses has been the rising significance and prevalence of so-called network effects that occur when increased usage of a product or service boosts the value of that product or service for other users. For example, each additional Airbnb host makes a service a tiny bit more valuable for every other Airbnb guest and vice versa. Each additional WeChat user makes the service a tiny bit more valuable for every other WeChat user, and so on. Network effects generate a positive feedback loop that can allow the first product or service that taps into those effects to build an unassailable competitive advantage. For example, eBay was founded in 1995, yet network effects keep it a dominant player in peer-to-peer commerce 2 decades later. Airbnb offers over 3 million listings in 65,000 cities around the world. Think of how difficult it would be for a new entrant to offer anywhere close to the same selection and value. We're reminded of the famous scene from the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, in which Alec Baldwin's character, Blake, is speaking to a group of salesmen. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anyone want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. Get the picture? First prize in the first wave of consumer social networking went to Facebook. Second prize to MySpace. Third prize to Friendster. Remember Friendster? You need to win first prize in order to survive in the internet era. The level of competition can seem overwhelming at times, but the networked age also allows companies to reap incredible rewards much more rapidly than at any other point in history. We call the strategy and mindset they use to get there blitzscaling. Blitzscaling is a strategy and a set of techniques for driving and managing extremely rapid growth that prioritize speed over efficiency in an environment of uncertainty. Put another way, it's an accelerant that allows your company to grow at a furious pace that knocks the competition out of the water. Blitzscaling requires hypergrowth, but goes beyond the blunt strategy of get big fast, because it involves purposefully and intentionally doing things that don't make sense according to traditional business thinking. In the blitzscaling era, you have to make a tough call. Take on the additional risk and discomfort of blitzscaling your company, or accept what might be the even greater risk of losing if your competition blitzscales before you do. Was Airbnb's decision to expand into European markets a move that could have stretched the company so thin as to destroy its core business, either efficient or certain? Hardly. Airbnb could have easily failed, burning through all of its capital while essentially ceding the European market to its copycat competitor, Wimdu. Yet, the risky decision proved the right one. Blitzscaling disrupts entire industries such as music, video games, and telephony with both new technologies and new business models. And those are examples from just a single company. You know, the one that produced the iPod, iTunes, the iPhone, and the iPad, just to name a few. These waves of disruption affect every aspect of our daily lives, from the jobs we work, to the products we use, to the way we connect with one another. Disruption on its own is neither good nor bad, but it always involves change. Replacing a $10 product with a $1 product of equal or better quality looks like a disaster to an incumbent player. But for society as a whole, it means greater productivity. The buyer gets the desired product and now also has $9 available to invest in other things. Netflix has been bad news for broadcast and cable networks, but it has been great news for fans and creators of movies and television. Yes, disruption produces losers as well as winners, but as a whole, it is a vital source of growth and opportunity you cannot afford to ignore. It's good to keep in mind that those who extol the virtues of disruption tend to be, coincidentally enough, the ones in the winner's circle. But disruption that spreads its benefits and new opportunities broadly is better for society. Fortunately, most disruption falls into this category. In a 2004 working paper, Schumpeterian Profits in the American Economy, Theory and Measurement, Yale economist William Nordhaus examined the U.S. economy from 1948 to 2001. Based on the data he collected, he concluded that only 2.2% of profits that arise when firms are able to appropriate the returns from innovative activities went to the disruptors. Most of the benefits of technological change are passed on to consumers rather than captured by producers, he concluded. Like it or not, change is inevitable, but it doesn't have to be wholly unexpected. In their book Future Shock, the futurists, Alvin and Heidi Toffler, wrote that change is the only constant, and to survive, to avert what we have termed future shock, the individual must become infinitely more adaptable and capable than ever before. Those words were originally published in 1970. The pace of change has only accelerated since then. Everyone should have the opportunity to learn how blitzscaling works, because it is already impacting their lives. And once they know how it works, they can use it to reshape the world. People should be part of building the future rather than feeling like the future is being forced upon them. Blitzscaling is what separates the startups that get disrupted and disappear as the world changes from the ones that scale up to become market leaders and shape the future. This book was born out of a class we taught at Stanford in which we dissected the process that went into growing the world's largest technology companies and then codified a series of tactics and choices that made it work. The result was a specific set of principles that describes how to grow multi-billion dollar companies in a handful of years. While writing this book, we talked to hundreds of entrepreneurs and CEOs, including those of the world's most valuable companies, such as Facebook, Alphabet or Google, Netflix, Dropbox, Twitter, and Airbnb. You can hear a number of those conversations on my podcast, Masters of Scale. Even though the stories of their company's rise were very different in many ways, the one thing they all had in common was an extreme, unwieldy, risky, inefficient, do-or-die approach to growth. In this book, we draw lessons from these world-leading companies to explain the nuts and bolts of how to blitzscale, when to blitzscale, why to blitzscale, and the global impact of the companies that are blitzscaling all around you right this second. This quest will take us all over the globe, but one place in particular stands out. Silicon Valley, the perfect place to decode blitzscaling. Although companies have successfully blitzscaled on every continent except for Antarctica, the most prominent and most concentrated set of examples come from California's Silicon Valley. And while we can't simply copy and paste the techniques that work in Silicon Valley and expect them to work the same way in Shanghai, neither can we cut and paste from Shanghai to Stockholm, nor from Stockholm to Sao Paulo. Instead, we try to extract some universal lessons and then explore how they apply across the world. As of this writing, at the end of 2017, there were only 14 publicly traded technology companies in the world that have a market capitalization of over $100 billion. Want to guess how many of those were in Silicon Valley? 7. That's half of the world's most valuable tech companies. As of this recording, that number is up to 10 out of 17. Taken together, Silicon Valley's 150 most valuable publicly traded technology companies are worth $3.5 trillion. That number is so big, it doesn't mean anything to most of us. So consider this. Those 150 companies alone make up 50% of the value of the NASDAQ, and they account for over 5% of the entire world's market capitalization. That's a lot of value created by a region with an estimated 3.5 to 4 million residents, or roughly 0.05% of the world's population. While we fully accept that this may change in the future, the historical and current success of Silicon Valley makes it the perfect place to examine this question. What is the most effective way to rapidly build massively valuable companies? When outsiders look at Silicon Valley, they often think that the key to this question is innovative technology. But as you'll hear, technological innovation alone doesn't make for a thriving company. Silicon Valley insiders and well-read outsiders believe that the key is the combination of talent, capital, and entrepreneurial culture that makes it easy to start new companies. This, too, is wrong. Sure, Silicon Valley is the leading hub for high-tech talent and venture capital, but it didn't start out that way. Sure, it is blessed with great universities such as Stanford and Berkeley, but so are plenty of other regions. The answer can't be simply the combination of venture capital, research universities, and smart people. This combination of ingredients is far from unique. In fact, the same basic ingredients can easily be found in numerous startup clusters in the United States and around the world. Austin, Boston, New York, Seattle, Shanghai, Bangalore, Istanbul, Stockholm, Tel Aviv, and Dubai. To discover the secret to Silicon Valley success, you need to look beyond the standard origin story. When people think of Silicon Valley, the first things that spring to mind, after the HBO television show, of course, are the names of famous startups and their equally glamorized founders. Apple, Google, Facebook, Jobs, Wozniak, Page, Brin, Zuckerberg. The success narrative of these hallowed names has become so universally familiar that people from countries around the world can tell it just as well as Sand Hill Road venture capitalists. It goes something like this. A brilliant entrepreneur discovers an incredible opportunity. After dropping out of college, he or she gathers a small team who are happy to work for equity, sets up shop in a humble garage, plays foosball, raises money from sage venture capitalists, and proceeds to change the world. After which, of course, the founders and early employees live happily ever after, using the wealth they've amassed to fund both a new generation of entrepreneurs and a set of eponymous buildings for Stanford University's computer science department. It's an exciting and inspiring story. We get the appeal. There's only one problem. It's incomplete and deceptive in several important ways. First, while Silicon Valley and startups are used almost synonymously these days, only a tiny fraction of the world's startups actually originate in Silicon Valley. And this fraction has been getting smaller as startup knowledge spreads around the globe. Thanks to the internet, entrepreneurs everywhere have access to the same information. Moreover, as other markets have matured, smart founders from around the globe are electing to build companies in startup hubs in their home countries rather than immigrating to Silicon Valley. Second, simply starting a company is obviously insufficient. The startups that achieve massive value are those that have found a way to grow into scale-ups at an exponentially faster pace than their competitors. So what secret alchemy is at work in Silicon Valley to fuel such rapid-fire growth of so many of the world's most valuable tech companies? And if there is a secret, can it be identified, analyzed, understood, and most important, applied elsewhere? Blitzscaling is that secret. And the reason blitzscaling matters so much is that nothing about it is inherent to Silicon Valley. There's a common misconception that Silicon Valley is the accelerator of the world. The real story is the world keeps getting faster. Silicon Valley is just the first place to figure out how to keep pace. While Silicon Valley certainly has many key networks and resources that make it easier to apply the techniques we're going to lay out for you, blitzscaling is made up of basic principles that do not depend on geography. We're going to show you examples from overlooked parts of the United States, such as Detroit with Rocket Mortgage and Connecticut with Priceline, as well as from international companies such as WeChat and Spotify. In this process, you'll see how the lessons of blitzscaling can be adapted to help build great companies in nearly any ecosystem, albeit with differing degrees of difficulty. That's the mission of this book. We want to share the secret weapon that has allowed Silicon Valley to punch so much more than 100 times above its population index so that those lessons can be applied far beyond the 60-mile stretch between the Golden Gate Bridge and San Jose. It is sorely needed. Here's a startling fact. The global economy will need to create 600 million new jobs by 2030 to meet the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. That's less than 15 years away. The world needs more than just new companies and new jobs. It's going to need entire new industries. Those industries better generate scale-ups as well as startups. It seems to us that it'll be a lot easier to add 600 million new jobs worldwide by creating 60,000 new 10,000-person companies rather than 60 million new 10-person companies. The late, great Andy Grove, Intel's legendary CEO, understood and explained this when he wrote in a 2010 op-ed for Bloomberg. Startups are a wonderful thing, but they cannot by themselves increase tech employment. Equally important is what comes after that mythical moment of creation in the garage as technology goes from prototype to mass production. This is the phase where companies scale up. They work out design details, figure out how to make things affordably, build factories, and hire people by the thousands. Scaling is hard work, but necessary to make innovation matter. Recognizing what powers the rapid growth from startup to scale up and understanding the principles behind how it works will help entrepreneurs and companies apply these principles not just in small pockets of the United States and China, but around the world. Who should listen to this audiobook? This book is for anyone who wants to understand the techniques that allow a business to grow from zero to a multi-billion dollar market leader in a handful of years. These techniques should be of interest to entrepreneurs who want to build massive companies, venture capitalists who want to invest in them, employees who want to work for them, and governments and communities who wish to encourage the growth of these companies in their own regions. And even if you don't want to build, invest in, or work for any of these companies, you'll still need to navigate the world that they're building. If you are a manager or a leader who's trying to rapidly scale a project or business unit within a larger company, blitzscaling can help you too. And while we draw these lessons primarily from the world of high tech, many of the principles and frameworks the book lays out, especially regarding people management, are applicable to high-growth companies in most industries worldwide, from European fast fashion retailers to Texan oil shell companies. Even organizations outside the business world can use blitzscaling to their advantage. Upstart presidential campaigns and nonprofits serving the underprivileged have used the levers of blitzscaling to overturn conventional wisdom and achieve massive results. You'll hear all these stories and many more. Whether you are a founder, a manager, a potential employee, or an investor, we believe that understanding blitzscaling will allow you to make better decisions in a world where speed is the critical competitive advantage. With the power of blitzscaling, the adopted son of a Syrian immigrant, Steve Jobs, the adopted son of a Cuban immigrant, Jeff Bezos, and a former English teacher and volunteer tour guide, Jack Ma, we're all able to build businesses that changed and are still changing the world. The strategy and techniques we describe in this book are based on my experiences as a member of the founding team at PayPal, as co-founder, CEO, and now executive chairman at LinkedIn, as a leading investor in Facebook and Airbnb, and as an investor at Greylock Partners, where I've worked with many other billion-dollar companies, such as Workday, Pandora, Cloudera, and Pure Storage. My partners at Greylock and I have helped these companies go from garage to global dominance. And in this book, we'll share with you what we believe are important frameworks for understanding and addressing the challenge of blitzscaling across the different elements of your organization. Yet, as many good business books disclaim, while this is a playbook and a strategy guide, it isn't a book of precise recipes. Regardless of how the popular press portrays things, each formula for building a great company is unique and depends on the market opportunity, the founders, and the network in which they operate. The truth is, there is absolutely nothing guaranteed as a one-size-fits-all, must-follow rulebook for everyone. However, there are patterns. So in addition to individual tips and tricks, this book offers a set of frameworks and strategies for leaders, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs to adapt to their own needs and circumstances. A quick note on the term blitzscaling. The term blitzscaling derives from the 20th century usage of blitz as a way of describing a sudden, all-out effort. The first usage of blitz in this way was to describe the blitzkrieg, the lightning war strategy that General Heinz Guderian devised for the initial military campaigns of Nazi Germany during World War II. Ironically enough, Guderian was heavily influenced by British military thinkers like Basil Littlehart and J.F.C. Fuller, and the term blitzkrieg was actually popularized by the British press. The German military never formally adopted it. The advancing armies in these campaigns abandoned the traditional approach of moving at the slow pace at which they could establish secure lines of supply and retreat. Instead, they fully committed to an offensive strategy that accepted the possibility of running out of fuel, provisions, and ammunition, risking potentially disastrous defeat in order to maximize speed and surprise. The speed of these armies' advance shocked and overwhelmed their opponents, allowing the blitzkriegers to outmaneuver and outfight the defending forces. The early success of the German army helped spread the lessons of blitzkrieg to all the forces in the war. For example, the American general, George S. Patton, later put these lessons to good use in leading the U.S. Third Army's advance from the beaches of Normandy all the way to Berlin. Since then, the term blitz has been used to describe everything from an American football play to the way in which large companies roll out new products. Like the all-out blitz defense in football, which involves the risky move of sending every available defender to pursue the quarterback, or the proverbial marketing blitz of television, print, and online advertising that accompanies the release of a new blockbuster movie, blitzscaling strives for a relentless and dizzying speed that overwhelms the market. While we are wary of the negative connotations of blitz, especially in those nations that felt the effects of blitzkrieg in World War II, we believe that the strength of the metaphor and the widespread and colloquial use of the term in non-military contexts make it the best fit for the concepts discussed in this book.
Part 1. What is blitzscaling? Blitzscaling is what we call both the general framework and the specific techniques that allow companies to achieve massive scale at incredible speed. If you're growing at a rate that is so much faster than your competitors that it makes you feel uncomfortable, then hold on tight. You might be blitzscaling. Amazon's incredible growth in the late 1990s and up through today is a prime example of blitzscaling. In 1996, a pre-IPO Amazon Books had 151 employees and generated revenues of $5.1 million. By 1999, the now public Amazon.com had grown to 7,600 employees and generated revenues of $1.64 billion. That's a 50 times increase in staff and a 322 times increase in revenue in just 3 years. In 2017, Amazon had 541,900 employees and was forecast to generate revenues of $177 billion, up from $136 billion in 2016. Dropbox founder Drew Houston described the feeling produced by this kind of growth when he told me, "It's like harpooning a whale. The good news is, you've harpooned a whale. And the bad news is, you've harpooned a whale." While blitzscaling may seem desirable, it is also fraught with challenges. Blitzscaling is just about as counterintuitive as it comes. The classic approach to business strategy involves gathering information and making decisions when you can be reasonably confident of the results. Take risks, conventional wisdom says, but take calculated ones that you can both measure and afford. Implicitly, this technique prioritizes correctness and efficiency over speed. Unfortunately, this cautious and measured approach falls apart when new technologies enable a new market or scramble an existing one. Chris earned his MBA from Harvard Business School in the late 1990s, during the dawn of the networked age. Back then, his MBA training focused on traditional techniques, such as using discounted cash flow analysis to make financial decisions with greater certainty. Chris also learned about traditional manufacturing techniques, such as how to maximize the throughput of an assembly line. These methods focused on achieving efficiency and certainty, and the same emphasis was reflected in the broader business world. The world's most valuable company during that time, General Electric, was beloved by Wall Street analysts for its ability to deliver consistent and predictable earnings growth. But efficiency and certainty, while innately appealing and very important in the context of a stable established market, offer little guidance to the disruptors, inventors, and innovators of the world. When a market is up for grabs, the risk isn't inefficiency. The risk is playing it too safe. If you win, efficiency isn't that important. If you lose, efficiency is completely irrelevant. Over the years, many have criticized Amazon for its risky strategy of consuming capital without delivering consistent profits. But Amazon is probably glad that its inefficiency helped it win several key markets, online retail, ebooks, and cloud computing, to name just a few. When you blitzscale, you deliberately make decisions and commit to them, even though your confidence level is substantially lower than 100%. You accept the risk of making the wrong decision and willingly pay the cost of significant operating inefficiencies in exchange for the ability to move faster. These risks and costs are acceptable because the risk and cost of being too slow is even greater. But blitzscaling is more than just plunging ahead blindly in an effort to get big fast to win the market. To mitigate the downside of the risks you take, you should try to focus them. Line them up with a small number of hypotheses about how your business will develop so that you can more easily understand and monitor what drives your success or failure. You also have to be prepared to execute with more than 100% effort to compensate for the bets that don't go your way. For example, anyone who knows Jeff Bezos knows that he didn't simply mash his foot down on the gas pedal. Amazon has intentionally invested aggressively in the future, and despite its accounting losses, generates a ton of cash. Amazon's operating cash flow was over $16 billion in 2016, but it spent $10 billion in investments and $4 billion paying down debt. Its seemingly meager profits are a feature of its aggressive strategy, not a bug. Blitzscaling requires more than just courage and skill on the part of the entrepreneur. It also requires an environment that is willing to finance intelligent risks with both financial capital and human capital, which are the essential ingredients for blitzscaling. Think of them as fuel and oxygen. You need both to propel the rocket skyward. Meanwhile, the infrastructure of your organization is the actual structure of your rocket, which you're rebuilding on the fly as you rise. Your job as a leader and an entrepreneur is to make sure that you have sufficient fuel to propel your growth while making the necessary mechanical adjustments to the actual rocket ship to keep it from flying apart as it accelerates. Fortunately, this is more possible today than it has ever been in the past. Software is eating and saving the world. Historically, stories of breakneck growth involved either computer software, which offers nearly unlimited scalability in terms of distribution, or software-enabled hardware, such as the Fitbit fitness tracker or Tesla electric car, whose software component allows the company to innovate on software timescales, days or weeks, rather than hardware timescales, years. Moreover, The speed and flexibility of software development allow companies to iterate and recover from the inevitable missteps of haste. What's especially exciting these days is that software and software-enabled companies are starting to dominate industries outside of traditional high tech. My friend Mark Andreessen has argued that software is eating the world. What he means is that even industries that focus on physical products, atoms, are integrating with software, bits. Tesla makes cars, atoms, but a software update, bits, can upgrade the acceleration of those cars and add an autopilot overnight. The spread of software and computing into every industry, along with the dense networks that connect us all, means that the lessons of blitzscaling are becoming more relevant and easier to implement, even in mature or low-tech industries. To use a computing metaphor, technology is accelerating the world's clock speed, the rate at which central processing units, CPUs, operate, making change occur faster than previously thought possible. Not only is the world moving faster, but the speed at which major new technology platforms are being created is reducing the downtime between the arrivals of each wave of innovation. Before, individual waves would sweep through the economy one at a time, technologies like personal computers, disk drives, and CD-ROMs. Today, multiple major waves seem to be arriving simultaneously, technologies like the cloud, AI, AR/VR, not to mention more esoteric projects like supersonic planes and hyperloops. What's more, rather than being concentrated narrowly in a personal computer industry that was essentially a niche market, today's new technologies impact nearly every part of the economy, creating many new opportunities. This trend holds tremendous promise. Precision medicine will use computing power to revolutionize healthcare. Smart grids use software to dramatically improve power efficiency and enable the spread of renewable energy sources like solar roofs. And computational biology might allow us to improve life itself. Blitzscaling can help these advances spread and magnify their sorely needed impact. The types of scaling. Blitzscaling isn't simply a matter of rapid growth. Every company is obsessed with growth. In any industry, you live and die by the numbers: user acquisition, margins, growth rate, and so on. Yet growth alone is not blitzscaling. Rather, blitzscaling is prioritizing speed over efficiency in the face of uncertainty. We can better understand blitzscaling by comparing it to other forms of rapid growth. Classic startup growth prioritizes efficiency in the face of uncertainty. Starting a company is like jumping off a cliff and assembling an airplane on the way down. Being resource efficient lets you glide to minimize the rate of descent, giving you the time to learn things about your market, technology, and team before you hit the ground. This kind of controlled, efficient growth reduces uncertainty and is a good strategy to follow while you're trying to establish certainty around what the authors Eric Ries and Steve Blank call product market fit. Your product satisfies a strong market demand for the solution to a specific problem or need. Classic scale-up growth focuses on growing efficiently once the company has achieved certainty about the environment. This approach reflects classic corporate management techniques such as applying hurdle rates so that the return on investment, ROI, of corporate projects consistently exceeds the cost of capital. This kind of optimization is a good strategy to follow when you're trying to maximize returns in an established, stable market. Fast scaling means that you're willing to sacrifice efficiency for the sake of increasing your growth rate. However, because fast scaling takes place in an environment of certainty, the costs are well understood and predictable. Fast scaling is a good strategy for gaining market share or trying to achieve revenue milestones. Indeed, the financial service industry is often happy to finance fast scaling, whether by buying stocks and bonds or lending money. Analysts and bankers feel confident that they can create elaborate financial models that work out to the penny the likely ROI of a fast scaling investment. Blitzscaling means that you're willing to sacrifice efficiency for speed, but without waiting to achieve certainty on whether the sacrifice will pay off. If classic startup growth is about slowing your rate of descent as you try to assemble your plane, blitzscaling is about assembling that plane faster, then strapping on and igniting a set of jet engines, and possibly their afterburners, while you're still building the wings. It's do or die, with either success or death occurring in a remarkably short time. Given these definitions, You might wonder why anyone would ever pursue blitzscaling. After all, it combines the gut-wrenching uncertainty of startup growth with the potential for a much bigger, more embarrassing, more consequential failure. Blitzscaling is also hard to implement. Unless you're like Microsoft or Google and can finance your growth from an exponentially growing revenue